and closer to the outskirts of Philadelphia. Large coaches raced by our small cart, and when our driver picked up the pace, joining the pandemonium, more than once I anxiously glanced back to make sure that Henry, clinging tight, was still with us. As we entered the city, we slowed again to merge onto the gray cobbled streets, where I gaped in disbelief at the towering 3- and 4-story brick buildings that lined the streets. On my flight from Tall Oaks, I had been so frightened and then so ill that I had scarcely taken note of any town that our coach drove through. But now, wholly alert, I stared about at the frantic pace of the city as we passed row upon row of vast buildings, most of which had overlarge signs announcing their wares. Tobacco and cigars, coffee, boots and shoes. I had never imagined so many offerings all in one place. When we arrived at Market Street, huge green awnings stretched out over brick walkways to shelter what was offered for sale. Men, women, and children, many burdened with multiple baskets, called out to one another, adding to the bedlam as they scurried among the stalls. We passed first the fishmongers, the smell of fish ripe in the air, and then the farmers selling their vegetables, heaped high in barrels and boxes. Next to them, women wrapped in white aprons sold butter, cheese, and brown and white eggs. From my wagon seat, I could see butchers in bloody aprons farther on down, cutting away at slabs of red meat while customers waited in line. Our driver pulled his horse to a stop under one of the awnings, then leaped down to hitch his horse in such a way that the back of the cart could serve as a stall for his produce. After we thanked the driver for the ride, Henry led us away while I stumbled over my own feet as I gawked. It took a while before we found Lombard Street, but the storefront sign displaying 3 prominent balls, the mark of a pawn shop, was easy to find. I hesitated at the door when Henry insisted I go in alone. Fingering the ring in my pocket, I felt a sudden reluctance to sell it. Would Grandmother be angry with me for doing this? Yet I needed to find work and a place to stay. I reminded myself that I had other pieces of her jewelry sewn into the lining of my jacket, so I took a deep breath and stepped into the shop. The vendor was eager to have the ring, and any hesitation I had quickly left when a good-sized purse was offered in exchange for the jewelry. It felt like a small fortune, and on my exit, I greeted Henry with a smile as I held up my gain. He frowned.
"You best put that away," he said.
And though I quickly put it in my pocket, he scolded.
"What happened to you back at the tavern? You don't learn nothing?"
"I just wanted you to see," I said.
"I don't need to see nothing," he said.
At another time, I might have felt the sting of his criticism more acutely, but since I had achieved success with the sale, my mood was light.
"Let's go back to where we came in, to Market Street," I said. "There was so much to see."
"Don't forget you looking for work," Henry said.
"Today?" I said.
"Winter coming," he reminded me.
Even though his words sobered me, I could not stop my growing excitement as I stared at all there was around me.
"Look at this," I pointed out to Henry over and over again, and more than once Henry quietly reminded me to keep moving if I stopped short to observe shoppers or tradesmen at their work.
We were not far from Market Street when I caught sight of a beautiful window display. Through a large pane of glass, sun shone in on 2 silver birds, posed as though they were strutting about, their long tails dragging down behind them.
"Look," I said to Henry, "silver peacocks."
Henry moved in for a better look.
"Grandmother had 2 silver birds just like these.
They always sat on our dining room table, but when I was younger, she let me play with them. She said that they had been purchased in Philadelphia."
I thrilled at the sudden remembrance.
"Do you think they made them here?"
I asked, but Henry only shrugged indifferently. I looked up at the sign overhead. "Burton's Silversmith." Then I noticed a sign set to the side of the birds.
"The sign says that they need help," I said.
Henry brightened.
"You got to go on in," he urged. "I wait out here."
"You want me to go in there, now?"
"Good a place as any."
With no job skills to offer, I was embarrassed to present myself, but I decided to at least make a show of it to appease Henry. A bell startled me when it rang on my entry, and an older man, seated at a table behind a counter, looked up. Though he continued to polish a silver object,
He glanced at me over spectacles that sat on the end of his short nose. He was seated beside a window, and the sun shone through his white hair that circled out from around the pale, bald top of his head. I turned to the display case in front of me, filled with snuff boxes and watch chains, but something else had caught my eye. I went closer in and saw the same tubular whittling knife that I had taken from my home at Tall Oaks and now carried in my pocket. I leaned down to get a better view. The man put down his polishing tool.
"May I assist you?" he asked.
"I have one just like that," I said, enthused to see another familiar object.
"The apple corer?" he asked, giving it a name.
"Yes," I said, tapping on the case. "An apple corer. One such as this. I use it to whittle." He scraped back his tool as he stood.
"Would you like to see it?" he asked.
"No," I said, stepping back, alarmed that I had misrepresented myself. I saw those birds in the window. They are splendid. My grandmother has the same, although hers are smaller. Did you make them here?"
"We did," he said.
"How did you do it?" I asked, shaking my head in wonder.
"Are you interested in becoming a silversmith?" he asked, peering at me over his glasses.
"Is that what your sign is for? You want someone to help you make silver?"
"One doesn't make silver, young man. One works with silver. We pour it, we shape it, we hammer it, but we do not make it."
Though he was direct, there was a kindness to the man, and because of it, I dared ask my next question. "Could I learn how to make birds like that?" I asked, pointing back toward the window display.
"You are seeking employment?"
He scanned my clothing and gave a quick look at my affected eye. "Yes," I said. "I need to work."
"And what, sir, do you have for education?" he asked.
"I am good at reading and writing and mathematics. Oh, and I know some Latin." His close scrutiny made me uncomfortable, and I glanced back at the birds in the window. "And I can carve a true likeness," I said, quickly withdrawing from my burlap bag two miniature birds and a rabbit I had whittled recently. I placed them on the counter.
"Oh,"
he said in surprise. He picked them up and held them to the light to study their silhouette.
"These are quite remarkable,"
he said, but again he looked at my affected eye.
"Does your eye give you trouble when you do close-up work? Does it tire easily?"
"No," I said. "My eye is good." He set the rabbit down on the counter, then positioned the birds on either side of it. He fussed with their placement until he was satisfied, then stepped back to look at them again.
"As miniatures, these are quite exceptional," he repeated.
Quickly, I dug out my sketchbook. "I'm good at drawing birds, but I can draw other things as well." He took the small pad from my hand and slowly paged through, then closed it and handed it back to me. "I didn't have paint," I said. "They would be much better." He raised his hand to stop me.
"You have quite a talent, young man."
I saw hope. "Could I work here then?"
"Tell me, where are you from?" he asked.
The question so startled me that my mouth went dry. "I'm from Virginia," I said, "and I need to work." He cleared his throat.
"Well, let me put it to you this way. You say you wish employment, and it appears you have a great talent. I believe you could be well suited to this work. Your speech and dress suggest a certain refinement, but the scent of you and the outright dirt on your clothing have me questioning what you are about."
I looked down at myself. I had always been particular in my clothing and fastidious in my personal grooming, but in these past weeks out in the woods, I had forgotten my careful habits. I reached up and smoothed back my long hair, which had not seen water nor a brush since I had lost my satchel. What had I been thinking to present myself this way? My face was hot when I turned away, but as I hastened for the exit, he called out, "Young man?" I stopped to look back, my face burning.
"Cleanliness is what I'm after. If you're interested, do as I suggest, then come back to see me before the week is up."
Wanting only to escape, I nodded, then made a quick exit. Henry caught up to me as I briskly walked ahead.
"The man got no work?"
"He said I was a filthy pig," I said.
"A pig?" Henry said. "He said you a pig."
"Well, not in those words. He told me I need to get cleaned up."
"Then he gives you the job?"
"I'll never know," I said.
"Why you never know?"
Because he insulted me. I'm not going back, I said.
Henry looked about to make certain that we were alone, then he spoke in a low voice.
Now you thinking like a white boy. How you get ahead like that? You want something, you got to fight for it. That mean you got to get cleaned up and go on back there.
Furious, I strode on. But as I began to pass by some clothing shops, my fury lessened. I finally stopped in front of one display window that featured a white shirt and a beautifully tailored green velvet dress jacket. The gold lettering on the window read, "Gentleman's Clothing."
"Go on in," Henry encouraged. "Get you some new clothes. You got the money."
Embarrassed now at my appearance, I was reluctant to enter, but smarting from the silversmith's insults, I went in, determined to clean myself up. On my exit, I carried a new leather satchel packed with 3 white cotton shirts, 2 pairs of dark breeches, a black jacket, some stockings, and a fine pair of black shoes. I also now owned scissors, a hairbrush, and a sandalwood-scented bar of soap. I handed Henry a shining black satchel similar to my brown one.
"Open it," I said.
He gave me a look of surprise as he dug through his bag to find a new muslin shirt, a bar of soap, and a wooden hairbrush. He smelled the soap and said nothing, but from his slight smile, I could tell he was pleased. For 2 days, I could not find the courage to return to the city, but by the 3rd day, Henry insisted I go. I had scrubbed myself clean and was dressed in my new clothing when Henry again led me through the woods, but this time, when we came to the road, he handed me my satchel and encouraged me on my way.
"Aren't you coming?" I asked, alarmed.
"Time we cut ties," he said, avoiding my eyes. I looked around, trying to think of an excuse to have him come with me.
"Maybe I shouldn't go today. It looks like it's going to rain," I said.
Henry looked at the sky.
"Rain or shine, you got to go," he said.
I was about to plead, but his face hardened.
"Go on now. Time you get going. Go on now and do something with yourself."
I didn't know what else to do, what else to say. My throat seized up, and fearing that I might start to cry, I abruptly turned and walked away. I knew why Henry was sending me away, but I felt he was all I had left of family, and I was heartsick at leaving him. When tears fell, I wiped them away, but hungry for a last sight of him, I turned back to wave. He was already gone, and it took everything in me not to run back into the woods to find him. I waited a while, hoping he might come forth to surprise me, but finally, I turned back to the road and forced myself on. By the time another farmer on his way to the market offered me a ride, my new shoes had rubbed my heels raw and I was happy to accept. This wagon box was filled with baskets of alarmed chickens and I was grateful for the din, as it provided little opportunity for talk. Once in town, I went in search of the silversmith shop. By the time I found my way there, my feet were burning from blisters. Though the sign for help was still in the window next to the silver birds, I dreaded entering, sure of rejection. I dusted my pants clean and brushed at the front of my jacket, then stepped in to meet the same man who had seen fit to tell me to bathe. Surprisingly, he recognized me and greeted me with some enthusiasm.
"So," he said, "you are back."
He came from behind the display case to look me over.
"I see you took my advice."
"I did," I said, gripping tight to my satchel.
"I am pleased to see you," he said.
"You are?"
"I am. You have a talent, my boy. I was hoping that you would return, and now I see that you can accept direction."
I wasn't sure what to feel.
"So why did you return?" he asked.
"I need to work," I said.
"You would be willing to clean the floors?"
"Well, yes, I can clean floors if you show me how," I said, "but I would rather like to learn to work with silver."
"We could arrange for that, but it would take years to learn the craft," he said.
"Years?" I asked.
"Yes, but first you would have to start with cleaning the shop and running errands."
"Would you pay me?" I asked.
"Not if you are my apprentice."
My face must have fallen, for he added,
"But you will learn a trade, and while you are with me, I will supply your food and some coins as you might need them."
"I will need them," I said.
"Did you consult with your family?"
"I had only my grandmother," I said.
Your grandmother. And where is she?
I wasn't prepared for the question. She was in a fire. She died, I blurted out.
And your parents?
He asked.
They are dead, I lied. I have no one.
Unexpectedly, for the second time that day, I fought tears, and when one slipped down my face, I quickly wiped it away with my jacket sleeve. I don't like to talk about my grandmother, I said as explanation, though truthfully it was more likely the strain of leaving Henry, and now my fear of being caught in a lie. The man gave me a moment before he asked,
And what is your name?
I looked down at the floor and lied again. James Smith, I said, calling up the name Henry and I had decided upon.
And your age?
I glanced up and his expression was so unexpectedly kind that I told him the truth. I was 13 years this past February, I said. He nodded, then smiled.
13 is a good age to begin.
He stepped forward and offered his hand.
My name is Mr. Burton. Welcome.
Yet I hesitated. Where would I live? I had coins in my pocket, but I was reluctant to use them, as I hated the thought of selling more of grandmother's jewelry.
What is it?
He asked, noting my uncertainty. Do you know of a place where I could sleep? I asked.
Ah. Well, it is common enough to offer a new apprentice room and board, he said. I can provide that for you in my home, where you will be downstairs with our household help. Your room will be small, but it will be warm and dry, and you will have enough to eat. Would that arrangement suit you?
I was so relieved that I could only nod in reply. Chapter 10 1810 to 1811 James Unspeakably grateful for the man's generosity, I was silent in the carriage that first evening when Mr. Burton took me along to his home. I had spent the afternoon cleaning up the silver shop, but I had left Henry early that morning and I was dazed from the long day. It seemed a short ride before the horses turned down an alley that led to the back of a 4-story brick dwelling. After Mr. Burton and I left the carriage, the driver went on to the stables and my host led the way into the house through a back door that opened into a small square entry where a welcoming lamp was burning. From there I followed Mr. Burton down a short stairwell and into a large basement kitchen, where we were met by the scent of freshly baked bread and a simmering meat stew. The warmth and comfort of this large room contrasted sharply with the cold outside, but it was all so unfamiliar that I happily would have exchanged it for Henry and his outdoor fire. Mr. Burton went ahead to a long pine table in the center of the room. There he lifted a blue and white checked cloth.
Ah, Delia, he said, breathing in the scent of fresh bread.
A thin Negro woman turned from the vast fireplace.
Done not 2 hours ago, she said without a smile,
then went back to stirring the contents of the pot.
Don't tell me that's my favorite stewed beef, he said, sniffing the air.
Made just the way you likes it with the cloves and extra onions, she said.
Now that's a meal to look forward to, Delia, he said.
The woman placed the iron lid back on the pot, then picked up a small bucket and brought it over to slide the onion peels from the table. As I watched her work, her dark eyes kept darting in my direction.
How was Mrs. Burton today? My new employer asked.
Oh, she have a good day, Delia said.
She saw Malcolm? He asked.
Yes, sir, she go to his room. Like I say, she have a good day.
Fine, fine.
Mr. Burton looked back at me.
We're trying out a new apprentice for the shop. This is James, he said by way of introduction.
He waved toward a dark hallway.
Can we get that back room cleared out enough to make room for a bed?
The one across from the wine cellar? She asked.
That's the one, he said.
I get Ed to take out some of those barrels what holds the apples and—
Fine, fine, he answered, already on his way to the stairway.
Before he began to climb the steps, he addressed me again.
Delia will get you straightened out. Be ready to leave in the morning at 7.
Yes, sir,
I said, so grateful for his kindness that tears threatened. I soon sobered when Delia and I were left alone to stare at one another. Her brown muslin head rag was tied low on her forehead, and her face appeared to be set in a frown, though it might have been her low-slung jaw and heavy bottom lip that made it look so. Hers was not a handsome face.
"No white boy been put down here with us before," she said, clearly unhappy with my presence.
"And I'm not used to sleeping with servants," I said sharply. She gave me a quick, hard look. While I found her stare intimidating, I would not allow a Negro woman to speak to me in that way. She picked up one of the lamps and, while mumbling to herself, shuffled slowly across the zigzag pattern of the brick floor and into the dark hallway. When she sensed that I wasn't behind her, she turned back.
"You comin'?" she called.
I followed as she led the way to a small back room half filled with large barrels. In the lamplight, I saw there would be space enough to place a bed under the narrow window and away from the small fireplace.
"Set your bag down, and Ed see to get a pallet for tonight. Tomorrow we get a bed set up. What else you think you need in here?" she asked.
I decided it best to present a full list.
"I suppose I shall need a desk," I said,
"and a floor covering. Of course I will need a lamp and a washstand and a mirror."
"I say what you need, not what you wantin'," she said,
then abruptly left the room. Since she had the light, I had no choice but to trail back after her into the kitchen. With nothing else to do, I sat on a stool and watched as she bustled around, preparing a supper tray for the Burtons. When she finished, she carried it to a corner in the room and there opened a small trap door to load the tray inside. After she gave a few yanks to a cord, which rang a bell on the floor above us, there was a low rumble as someone in the dining room above began to use a pulley to bring the meal up. I couldn't stop myself.
"Who is up there?" I asked.
"Robert," she said.
"Robert?"
I asked. "He the butler."
"The butler?"
It was an unfamiliar word, one I could not recall having heard before, but I would not show my ignorance.
"That what I say,"
she said, then directed me to a corner of the table and set before me a large pewter spoon and a wooden bowl filled with the hot stew. Until now, I had felt too drained from the day's events to eat, but the aroma awakened my appetite. I was relieved to see that she was not joining me. It was one thing to share my meal with Henry out in the woods, but to sit at the table with a Negro house servant was another thing.
"Would you have a napkin?" I asked.
She went to a sideboard and opened a long drawer from which she pulled a folded white cloth that I suspected was used for drying dishes.
"This suit you?"
she asked, setting it down beside me.
"Thank you,"
I said, shaking it out and folding it across my lap before digging into the aromatic stew. Delia spread freshly churned butter over a thick slice of bread and handed it to me. She was cutting another slice of bread when she gave me a sly look.
"You know what a butler do?"
I dipped the bread into the sweet onion gravy, then took a bite and chewed it slowly before I replied.
"I'm assuming he collects supper trays?"
"He don't collect no nothing," she said.
"Well then," I said, curiosity getting the better of me, "I suppose that you had best inform me."
She glared at me.
"After Mr. Burton, Robert the boss of this house, so you best mind him."
"Surely he doesn't have charge over Mrs. Burton?" I asked.
"Mrs. Burton don't do a thing without asking me first," she said. "Ed and me was here before Robert."
As I took the second piece of bread that she handed me, I remembered the carriage driver.
"Is Ed your husband?"
I asked, more to make conversation than out of a need to know.
"Ed, my baby brother," she said.
Her baby brother? How old was she?
As though to answer my question, she said,
"We both been here with Mr. and Mrs. Burton since they buy us, but we free now. We's here a long time."
I asked if the Burtons had children.
"One boy. They bury him back when the yellow fever comes through, back in 93.
She looked at me and asked,
"That before you was born?"
Caught unaware, I didn't respond, so she asked another question.
"Where was you born?"
I worried that I might say the wrong thing.
"I prefer not to talk about myself," I said.
Having finished the meal, I rose to take my leave, then remembered my manners.
"That was an excellent supper," I said. "Thank you, Delia."
"That be Miss Delia," she said, and then went silent.
Fortunately, Ed soon came through with my pallet, and I followed him to my room. After he left, I sat down on the straw-filled mattress and looked around, dazed to find myself in this position. Until recently, I had known only luxury. Grandmother had raised me to be a gentleman, to have my own land and my own servants. Now I was sleeping in a storage room. What would Grandmother think to see me here? It had been weeks now, but still my heart clenched whenever I remembered that she was gone. Fully clothed, I lay back on the pallet. Unexpectedly, exhaustion won out, and I fell asleep. In the first months, I served as an errand boy for Mr. Burton, picking up supplies and making deliveries. Gradually, the turmoil of the streets affected me less, and as I got to know the layout of the city, I grew more confident. If I earned a penny or two from a satisfied customer, I offered the coins to Mr. Burton on my return to the shop. When he assured me that those were mine to keep, I stored them eagerly. When I wasn't out on deliveries, I was given the task of cleaning the three rooms of Mr. Burton's shop. Naturally, there was the storefront, where the glass cases and open shelves displayed some of the finest silver pieces, but Mr. Burton was as particular about his small office in the large room to the back where he and Nicholas, another silversmith, did their silver work. Before I was introduced to Nicholas, Mr. Burton took me aside.
"You should know that Nicholas has his peculiarities," he said.
"Yes, sir," I answered, wondering if he thought I had some of my own.
"He talks without thinking. That is, he seems incapable of censoring his thoughts. He has been like this from the beginning, but he means no harm."
Forewarned, I went with him to meet Nicholas, who was hard at work in the back room. The tall, heavy-set man paused only a moment when we were introduced, then twice slammed a hammer against a silver ingot. The muscles on his huge forearm bulged with the effort, and when he stepped back, he pulled a rag from under his leather apron to wipe dry his forehead as he considered me. "You got an odd look about you with that funny eye," Nicholas said by way of greeting. I had been born with a useless left eye cloaked with a white film, but until recently, I had given it little thought. During my childhood, those around me seldom, if ever, made note of it, but since my flight, its oddity had been pointed out more than once, and its mention now made me shift uncomfortably.
"Well, I did warn you," Mr. Burton said after we left the room. "Fortunately, he does not aspire to a business of his own, as his forthright comments are ill-suited to customers."
He chuckled.
"Oh, well, it is my good luck that he wants only to be left alone to work at his craft, for he is the true artisan here."
As proof of his words, he pointed out Nicholas's most recent work, an elegantly shaped teapot that even I, with no training, could appreciate.
"But here is how we make our real money," he said,
opening two oversized drawers filled with silver pieces.
"We supply these to fur trading posts for barter with the Indians."
He invited me to examine the rings, wristbands, and round silver cloak brooches.
"Indians buy these?" I asked, excited at this news. "Well, the fur traders buy them from me and offer these silver pieces as trade for pelts. The Indians wear them, particularly the men. There is a great demand for silver, and these are simple enough to make, but we can hardly keep up."
"Is it all right if I touch them?" I asked, and with his permission, I rifled through. I slipped a ring on my finger and moved my hand about in the air to better see the sparkle of the silver.
"Will you show me how to make these?"
I asked eagerly, but when he was slow to answer, I noted in surprise his moist eyes.
"I'm sorry," I said, quickly slipping off the ring. "No. No, you've done nothing wrong. It was the way you spoke just now. It was your excitement, you see. I had a son. You reminded me of him just then," he explained while using his knuckle to dab at a lone tear. "In answer to your question, yes, you will learn to make the rings, but you must be patient."
And so I was, dutifully carrying out my chores until a few weeks later, when Mr. Burton called me into his office. He sat at his large roll-top oak desk and had me take a seat across from him before he presented me with a document.
"James, I would like you to read this over and consider it carefully. If you sign, you are agreeing to be my apprentice. While I train you as a silversmith, I will continue to provide you with room and board. You will be with me for 7 years. But I am hoping that with your artistic talent, you will be established well before then."
"I don't need to read this. I will sign it," I said quickly and handed back the paper.
"No, young man,"
he said, giving it back to me.
You must always read through anything before you sign your name. Your signature is the same as giving your word, and keeping your word is the mark of a man's character. In the end, it is the most valuable thing a man possesses.
His words cut deep. He had asked a few times about my past, and each time I led him to believe that I was orphaned with no living relatives. Not only was I deeply grateful to him for having taken me into his home, I also respected this ethical man, and I wanted only to tell him the truth. But I was too afraid. I avoided his eyes when I took the paper from him again and hoped he didn't see how my hand shook when I signed the document as James Smith. Although my day still included making deliveries, I now was given the opportunity to assist Nicholas in the back room. Initially, I only worked the bellows for the forge, and though my arms grew tired, I found it fascinating to watch the silver coin melt and harden again after it was poured into molds. But it was when Nicholas reheated the ingots and hammered the silver into shape that the artistry began. He did it with such skill that he made the craft look easy. When he finally relented and helped me craft my first silver spoon, I was unprepared for the physical stamina required. After the ingot was heated, it took both strength and dexterity to secure the malleable silver with tongs and then hammer it flat against the anvil. My arm was already sore when we placed the flattened silver over the mold, and when Nicholas handed me yet another hammer, I rubbed my shoulder.
"Doesn't your arm get tired?" I asked.
"Nope."
"Mine does," I said, moving my shoulder up and down, expecting Nicholas to suggest I take a break.
But Nicholas was not like my grandmother, who had pampered me. Instead, he dismissed my complaint with a grunt and nodded for me to continue until the silver began to take shape. "Now, you gotta use a light touch," Nicholas said, finally handing over a small hammer required to complete the finishing. Mr. Burton came in just then, and as I tapped away, he asked what I was doing. "I'm doing the planishing," I said, quick to use the correct terminology, and when I saw Mr. Burton's approval, I forgot about my shoulder pain. My admiration and appreciation for the man had grown each day, and my one objective was now to please him. True, I wanted to learn the craft, but more, I wanted Mr. Burton's good opinion of me, and because of it, I dedicated myself to learning. Likely because of my artist's hand and eye, the iron punches, chisels, and saws soon grew as comfortable in my hands as my whittling knife. And when Mr. Burton recognized and congratulated me on each progressive step, I was as pleased with myself as I had ever been. Would that my transition into the Burton household had been as simple. Delia's meals were of good quality and served to me in the kitchen, where I always ate alone, which suited me. One day, when I saw the table set for three, indicating that I was to sit down with Delia and Ed, I said that I would take my meal to my room.
"Who that boy think he is?" I heard Delia ask her brother as I carried my food down the corridor. "He act high and mighty as that Robert," she added more quietly.
Curious, I stopped outside my door to listen for more.
"Now deal,
the boy white," Ed answered. "You know they don't eat with no colored folk." "Well, for sure he act white, but he hiding something. That much I know. He don't say nothing about where he come from or who his family be." "He hiding something," she repeated.
"Deal," Ed said.
"Even if that true, that his business. It my business to watch out for this house, and for sure it my business to care for Mr. and Mrs. Burton. I tell you, that boy hiding something."
Her insight terrified me, and from then on I was especially wary when fielding her questions.
"What you got in there?"
she asked one morning, making note of my leather satchel that I carried with me each day to work.
"My personal things," I said, gripping tight my bag that contained grandmother's jewelry.
Mr. Burton had noted it as well, but with him I was much more forthcoming and told him that it held some of my grandmother's things. He did not question me further and in fact provided me with a safe cupboard to store it in while I was at the shop.
"My personal things," Delia repeated, mimicking my voice, and though I wanted to hit her, I pretended not to mind.
I was grateful that her brother left me to myself as he went about his business of running the stables and seeing to the gardens, and if we shared an exchange, he always spoke to me with deference, a behavior that I was accustomed to. But then, there was Robert.
Before I met him, Delia made it clear that though he ran the household, the two of them did not see eye to eye. And from the beginning, I supposed it was because she resented the authority of a white man in her kitchen. One evening, some days after my arrival, I met the man when he made an unexpected appearance just as I was finishing my meal.
"Yes?" I asked, setting aside my fork and knife.
"I am Robert," he said, speaking with a slight clipped English accent that I was to learn came as a result of his 5 years of butler training in London. "Might we have a word after you finish dining?"
This was Robert? He was not a white man, as I had assumed, but an impeccably dressed, carefully groomed, and well-spoken Negro. What would grandmother have thought?
After I swallowed my surprise, I folded my napkin alongside my plate.
"I am available now," I said,
taking note of his starched white shirt and the spotless white apron tied around the waist of his dark trousers. Delia, heating water for washing dishes, shot me a satisfied glance before she looked to Robert with a slight smile. She hesitated after he suggested she go upstairs to see to Mrs. Burton, but she reluctantly did so while he waited patiently for her to leave. "I'll be in the pantry," he said, speaking in a way that left no doubt he was used to issuing orders. Irritated at being directed by a servant, I took my time to follow. I found him seated behind a desk in a room off the kitchen, working figures in an open ledger. His tall, thin frame sat erect, and his long, narrow feet, bound in shoes of black leather and polished to a high luster, set flat on the brick floor. It was difficult to assess his age, though when he looked up at me, I guessed him to be perhaps in his mid-30s. "Please sit." With his index finger, he indicated another chair across the table from himself. I declined to sit, stating a preference to remain standing.
"As you wish," he said.
"How may I help you?" I asked, irritated by his assuming demeanor.
"As you might know, I am butler of this house," he said.
"Yes," I said. "You understand, then, that I am responsible to speak to you about any household issues that arise?" I could not imagine what he was referring to. I waited until, with only silence between us, I was forced to speak.
"Go on," I said. "I understand that you have been leaving out your coat and boots for Delia to clean."
"I have," I said. "That is the duty of a servant, is it not?"
"You are correct in believing that it is what one might expect from one's servant. However, Delia is not your servant. When you live below stairs, as they say in England, you are considered one of the staff."
"One of the staff?" I was outraged. It was true that I was lodging in servants' quarters, but surely I wasn't considered one of them. They were Negroes.
"Yes, one of the staff. You are expected to look out for your own outer garments and your boots. Of course, you may expect Delia to continue to do laundry for you as she does for the rest of the household."
"I see," I said, and finding no rebuttal, I made a quick exit. I found it almost impossible to settle that night. True, I was angry that this black man thought of me as a servant, but what also disturbed me was the forceful yet eloquent way he had spoken. I had never seen the like. His sophisticated conduct, educated speech, and overall deportment belied everything grandmother had taught me about the Negro's limited capabilities. Sunday was a day I had to myself. On those mornings, Mr. Burton attended church services, and I generally took that day to stroll about town. But one Sunday morning in November, I remained in bed, feeling under the weather with a cold. I heard Ed bring around the carriage for Mr. Burton and listened as the horses clomped away. I meant to rise then, but the weather outside had turned wintry, and I decided to lay abed a while longer. I suppose I dozed, for I was startled awake by cries for help from Delia. I hesitated to respond, for it was Delia, after all, yet her call sounded so urgent that I yanked my trousers on over my nightshirt and rushed from my room.
"Upstairs!" Delia called when she saw me. "Come upstairs!"
Expecting a house fire or a similar emergency, I followed as she hurried up the back stairs. There in the hallway, light from a large fan window above the oversized front door streamed onto a chair where an older woman sat. She appeared to be struggling to breathe, but when I rushed to her side, she used her lace-edged handkerchief to wave me toward the dining room door. It was then I realized that though she was struggling for air, she was also laughing.
"Come, come!"
Delia called to me from the door to the dining room, and as she opened it, She pushed me through. No sooner did the door close behind me than a large white bird swooped past in a dive toward the dining room table. A feather duster slammed out from under it, further inciting the bird, and with a screech, the bird dove in again. To my amazement, I saw Robert under the table, wedged in between chairs and hitting out with the duster in an attempt to protect himself. "Throw the duster away," I called to him. "But I need it," he called back. "Throw it away," I repeated. "The bird thinks that it's another bird attacking him." The cleaning tool flew by me and crashed against the wall. As the white bird lit on it, I slid back two of the chairs. "Get out while he's distracted," I said. Needing no further encouragement, Robert scrambled up and out the door, leaving me alone to face the bird. But I was more fascinated than frightened by this beautiful creature. Seeing bread on the table, I made my way over to it and then sat quietly. When the bird took note of me, he flew over to perch on a neighboring chair. "Here," I said soothingly and fed him a chunk of bread. He continued to squawk and complain, but his crest of bright red-orange plumes was no longer at full tilt, and I was fairly certain that meant he was calming down. Suddenly, he flapped onto my shoulder, and between bites of bread began to gently nibble on my ear. Instinctively, I knew it to be a caress. There was a soft rap on the door.
"Hello? Are you alive in there?" a voice called.
"We are," I called back.
"I'm coming in,"
the woman announced, then slipped into the room. I rose from my chair, for I correctly guessed this to be Mrs. Burton. She hobbled over to the chair nearest me, and with the bird still on my shoulder, I received the canes that she handed me before she sat down to regulate her breathing. She was a short, heavy-set woman with a snub nose and a round, pleasant face. Her gray morning dress, the exact color of her braided hair, did nothing for her gray pallor.
"Sit," she instructed, and I did so. "You must be James Smith, my husband's new apprentice."
"I am," I said. The bird squawked for her attention. She laughed and waved her finger at him.
"Oh, Malcolm, you're a naughty boy flying away from me like that,"
she chuckled.
"Oh my, I haven't laughed like that since I can remember. Poor Robert, I don't know why he is so afraid of this bird."
She dabbed at her eyes as she began to laugh again. Her merriment was so appealing that I began to laugh too.
"What happened when you got in here?" she asked,
and I described what I had seen of the bird's attack on the feather duster.
"Under the table? Oh, stop,"
she said, laughing and gasping as she clutched my arm.
"I cannot breathe as it is."
"Naughty boy, naughty boy,"
Malcolm offered. At that we both whooped. And that was how Mr. Burton found us when he opened the door.
"What is going on?"
he asked, appearing bewildered to see me with Mrs. Burton.
"Oh, Mr. Burton,"
his wife sighed, drying her eyes.
"If only you had been here."
He came forward to kiss the top of his wife's head.
"It is good to hear you laugh,"
he said to her and smiled at me in thanks. I rose to leave, but Mrs. Burton reached for my arm.
"No, no, you must stay," she said. "Please stay. Come, husband, sit with us while we tell you." "Could we have some tea while you do so?"
Mr. Burton asked, stepping to the fireplace and rubbing his hands together.
"It is cold, and I am chilled."
I stood quickly. "I will go to the kitchen for it," I offered.
"Have Delia send up a pot of hot water and some cups. I have the tea caddy up here,"
Mrs. Burton said, nodding toward the sideboard.
"And don't forget to have her include a cup for yourself."
I felt light-hearted when I left the room, but I sobered myself before I got to the kitchen. I had concern that Robert would be embarrassed and possibly angry at my having witnessed his altercation with the bird, but to my surprise, he greeted me as the conquering hero. Not so Delia. As Robert sang my praises, her face puckered in annoyance, and when she heard of Mrs. Burton's request that I join her for tea, Delia looked at me in disbelief.
"You sure she mean that you go back up?" she asked.
"Yes," I said, trying to curb my anger. "She said that you were to include a cup for me." Delia clucked her tongue and shook her head. Her dislike of me only grew with each new encounter.
"And why should he not join them?" Robert said, addressing Delia. "They both need a distraction, Mrs. Burton in particular. A new face will be good for her."
Then he noted my nightshirt.
"But go," he said, "and dress yourself more appropriately."
So while Delia put together the tray, I went for a shirt and jacket. When I reappeared, Delia's look was so disapproving that when she carried the tray up, I kept a good distance behind her. In the dining room, after Delia set out the cups and was then dismissed, Mrs. Burton waved me to the sideboard.
Bring the caddy and the sugar canister to me, would you please?
I recognized the silver sugar canister, but was uncertain what held the tea.
It is the wooden pear,
she said, pointing to the small polished box cut in the perfect shape of a pear.
How pretty,
I said as I brought it to her.
Yes, isn't it?
She answered, smiling up at me, and I smiled back. I felt at ease with her. The way she looked at me reminded me of my grandmother. The tea caddy was beautiful. What kind of wood is it? I asked, rubbing my finger over the polished dark grain.
I believe it is rosewood, she said.
Rosewood? I asked. Mr. Burton, who had taken a seat at the table, joined in.
It is a wood found in the tropics, he said.
Addressing his wife, he went on.
This young man is quite gifted with drawing and also has a talent for carving.
You do?
She asked, taking the pear-shaped box from me.
Perhaps I could see some of your work.
I flushed with the unexpected attention and stood silently by as Mrs. Burton fingered the chatelaine at her waist until she found the right key to unlock the tea caddy. Then, after carefully measuring out what was needed of the aromatic black leaves, she locked the box again and had me return the caddy to its place on the sideboard. Mrs. Burton tapped at the chair next to her, and I sat.
Mr. Burton tells me that you were a quick study.
I glanced over at my employer. I like the work very much, I said. Malcolm squawked, and Mrs. Burton turned to her husband.
Could I ask you to return Malcolm to his room? He has had something to eat, and I don't want to have to ask Robert to clean up after his enemy.
Oh, my, Mr. Burton rose quickly. He held out his arm and spoke with authority. Come on, you naughty boy. You've created enough of a stir for one day.
Naughty boy! Naughty boy!
Malcolm said to the room on his departure, causing another round of laughter. As soon as her husband was out of the room, Mrs. Burton turned to me.
So tell me now, do you genuinely enjoy your work?
I answered her honestly.
Oh, yes,
I said, but then became concerned. Does Mr. Burton have a complaint?
Not at all,
she said, giving me a smile. I sighed in relief and again returned her smile.
I am relieved to know that. Malcolm certainly took to you, she said. You like birds, I take it?
I do, I said. I've been interested in them all of my life.
When did this interest begin?
She asked. It began when I was a child and was given a book that had beautiful illustrations of birds. After I taught myself to copy their likenesses from the book, I spent hours and hours at the window, drawing birds that nested outside in our trees.
Why did you not go outdoors? She asked. Were you ill?
No, I was in good health, but my grandmother needed me at her side, I said. When she was very ill, I would draw, and I could forget everything around me. While Mrs. Burton checked the readiness of the tea, I looked around. And for the first time since my arrival in Philadelphia, I felt a stirring of content. This room reminded me of home, of tall oaks, with the high ceilings, the vibrant green walls, the tall windows draped in gold velvet, and the long polished dining table and sideboard. An attractive portrait of a young Mrs. Burton hung over the mantel, and on the opposite wall was a portrait of Mr. Burton, painted when he had a full head of hair.
Were we not a handsome couple?
She asked, seeing my interest.
You were very beautiful, but it is odd to see Mr. Burton with all of that hair, I said.
She laughed aloud.
That was unkind, I said, feeling my face grow hot. It would have been insensitive if he were here to have heard it, she said. But I see no need for either of us to repeat it.
Thank you, I said. Mr. Burton has been very kind to me.
And how is it that you came to Philadelphia? She asked. Where is your family?
My heart began to pound. When I was a child and grandmother's hysteria frightened me, I learned to calm myself by quietly counting each finger before interlocking my hands. Now I did the same until, hands folded, I answered Mrs. Burton.
I am alone, I said. My mother, that is, my grandmother, died. And your parents?
I looked away.
They are both dead,
I lied.
My grandmother raised me.
I see, she said. And was your grandmother's death recent?
Yes. There was a fire.
In her home?
Yes, in our home. We had a farm.
How unspeakably sad for you, she said softly.
My eyes stung from her unexpected words of empathy. How tempted I was to tell her the truth.
And you were left destitute?
I have grandmother's jewelry, I said, but I don't want to sell it.
I hung my head and mumbled.
It is all that I have left of her.
I understand, dear boy. I lost my only son 17 years ago.
But his room stands as he left it. Even now, the loss is difficult for me to talk about.
Until this moment, no one had acknowledged my grief, and her words touched me deeply. Not only did she understand, but she had suffered the same. My attachment to Mrs. Burton began that day. I wanted to see Mrs. Burton again. I had a plan. At work on Monday morning, I asked Nicholas for help in locating a paper and art supply store. He knew of such a place, and in the afternoon, with Mr. Burton's approval and coins in my pocket, I went out to find it. I had not imagined a shop as wonderful as this. I had never seen embossed paint cake sold for watercolor, nor had I ever imagined such an assortment of brushes and paper. A clerk helped me select what I required, and I was so excited on my return to the silver shop that I found it difficult to focus on the silver polishing that Nicholas had set out for me to do. That evening I ate quickly, then, as usual, went off to my room. I worked late into the night and did so every night throughout the week. By Saturday evening I was satisfied, and on Sunday morning, after Mr. Burton left for church, I rolled up the small watercolor of Malcolm and gave it to Robert, asking that he give it to Mrs. Burton. He eyed the roll with some curiosity, but he acted on my request. Later, as I had hoped, Robert returned with an invitation for me to join Mrs. Burton in what was known as Malcolm's room. From the kitchen, I followed Robert up to a second flight of stairs to the third floor, and there to a large and open landing. As we walked down the long hallway, past Mr. and Mrs. Burton's bedrooms, I noted a handsome tall case clock. I had never seen one, but had read of the pendulum workings, and I paused at the shining black walnut case, intrigued by the loud click-clock sound it made. When the machine suddenly bonged, I yelped in surprise, startling Robert. He gave me a sour look, for he was already on edge, having earlier voiced his concern about Malcolm being safely ensconced in his cage. After Robert knocked on one of the doors, he gave me a look of relief when I offered to enter before him.
"Hello again, young man,"
Mrs. Burton welcomed me from a chair that sat next to the fireplace.
"Greetings,"
Malcolm interrupted in a perfect imitation of Robert's voice.
"I say greetings."
Robert gave a nervous glance, but Malcolm was in his large white metal cage. Malcolm grew louder.
"Greetings! Greetings!"
"You had best say hello to him. He won't stop until you do,"
Mrs. Burton said to him.
"Robert, you go ahead. I'll ring if I need you," she instructed.
I was as intrigued by the bird as before. But when I reached my hand in to stroke his feathers, he put his beak around one of my fingers.
"Careful,"
I said, lowering my tone. He held it, though he did not bite down. "Naughty bird," I said. And when he released me to repeat the phrase, I laughed aloud.
"Bring him out if you like," my hostess instructed.
Malcolm danced nervously while I worked to undo the enormous latch.
"Offer him your arm,"
Mrs. Burton said, and when I did, the bird hopped on. As I made my way over to her, Malcolm climbed up my arm to sit on my shoulder, and there took hold of my earlobe. I warned in a low voice. He repeated to me, and when I laughed, he mimicked that too. I glanced to see if Mrs. Burton was enjoying this as much as I, and though she smiled, she appeared to have something else on her mind. She pointed to a red velvet wingback.
"Come sit with me," she invited.
When I did so, the bird flew up to a perch that swung in front of a window.
"You have a remarkable understanding of him."
"He is beautiful," I said, settling myself into the chair.
"He belonged to my son," she said.
"Did Malcolm miss him after he...
I stopped myself, wondering if I should have brought up such a painful topic.
When Gerard passed, Malcolm was as upset as I was. He wouldn't eat for days, and he didn't speak for months. For me, it was almost a consolation to see him so lost. He was as devastated as I, she said.
As she spoke, the bird flew back and lit on my shoulder to nuzzle my ear with his beak. She dabbed at tears.
Forgive me, she said. It touches me to see him respond to you this way. He was never the same after we lost Gerard, and he has been something of a problem for us, but I couldn't let go of him. Now seeing him with you, well, this is how he behaved with Gerard.
I don't want to make you cry, I said. Should I put him away?
No, no, I've finished with my tears, she said,
then blew her nose and gave me a tender look.
Thank you for being so thoughtful, though. Your grandmother certainly raised you well. May I call you James? She asked.
Or Jamie, I suggested.
Is it the name your grandmother used for you?
I nodded, afraid to speak. Her voice was soft.
Well then, I will call you Jamie.
She studied me, though gauging my sensitivity about the upcoming subject.
Jamie, I have a personal question for you. It is about your eyes.
Yes? I asked, looking at her warily. Recently, with others noting it, I had become sensitive to the subject.
Does your good eye pain you when you paint? That is to say, do you feel that you put a strain on it?
No, I said. It doesn't bother me.
Good, she said. I was hoping for that. Pertaining to your affected eye, might I have a suggestion?
Yes, I said again.
My husband has a friend, one who, in his youth, lost an eye. He wears a black patch to cover it, and I must say that all of the ladies considered it quite dashing. I was wondering if you would care to have something similar fashioned for you.
Well, yes, I would give it a try.
That is settled, then.
She looked down at my painting in her lap.
Jamie, she said, this is one of the best representations of a salmon-crested cockatoo that I have ever seen.
I did the best I could from memory.
It is so fine that I will have it framed. Have you ever considered attending some art classes?
Grandmother often spoke of it, I said. But now, she smiled.
Well, dear, your grandmother was right. You have a God-given talent. We must have it developed.
Malcolm, seeking attention, gave a human chortle so true that he startled both of us. We looked at each other and giggled, then burst out laughing when Malcolm repeated himself.
Oh, dear, Mrs. Burton said, drying her eyes and then smiling at me. You have no idea how good it is to laugh again.
But I did. I did. I had not laughed since grandmother's death, nor had I felt this comfortable with another since fleeing my home. I liked and admired Mr. Burton for the man he was, but Mrs. Burton represented all I had lost with grandmother, and I only wanted more. The following Sunday, I was invited to join the Burtons for their Sunday dinner, and there was no want of conversation. As soon as Robert served the soup, my host and hostess began to entertain me with stories of their earlier life. Before their son was born, they had traveled to the West.
She was fearless, Mr. Burton said of his wife. You should have seen her. She rode.
I rode astride the horse, she interrupted. If my parents had seen me... No side saddles were to be found. What freedom!
When she giggled like a young girl, I noticed Mr. Burton and Robert exchanging a smile.
Do you remember what I wore, Mr. Burton? She asked.
How could I forget? You wore my trousers, he exclaimed, then addressed me. I will never forget the sight of my young wife flying through the tall grass on that spotted Indian pony.
It was brown and white and went like the wind.
Mr. Burton beamed as his wife came to life, while I moved to the edge of my chair.
Was it a true Indian pony? I asked.
Mr. Burton nodded.
It was given to her by the Indians.
You actually met Indians?
They assured me they had, and my eager questions tumbled out, making our meal such a success that I was invited back. The Burtons had lived a full life and became enlivened when they relived their stories. I was enthralled, not having imagined such lives of adventure,